seated. We are delighted to reconvene. And we have Mr. N and Mr. Howley on the second case this morning. And let me welcome two school groups before we proceed. Would the Brown Deer High School students please rise? Ooh, look at all of them. Good to see you all. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And would Malcolm Shabazz City High School students please stand? Good seeing all of you also. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The school groups are with us with a national award-winning program cleverly entitled Court with Class, sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Students from around the state are invited to join us. If the students come, they're given material relating to the case they will hear. They may engage in activities relating to the case, and then have the opportunity often to meet with a justice of the court who will discuss the procedure of the court with the students, not the substantive matters in the case. So we're delighted to have you join us. It's my understanding you may have to leave before we complete the hearing on this case, or perhaps leave during our first part of the next case, and we understand that and thank you for coming. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, we will proceed to Mr. N. I should ask, do the students expect to hear the third case, which was in Office of Lawyer Regulation case, or expect to hear this one? Pardon me? Hear the next case? Okay. Do you have summaries of this case? The marshal, deputy marshal, will hand out summaries. Oh, you've got them already? Got it. You're way ahead of me. If you read that quickly.
Oh, man.
Well, we'll talk about that later. you read it quickly, you'll have an understanding of the case. The plaintiffs here have already had spoken this morning on their side and have challenged the trial court proceedings. We'll now hear from Mr. End, who I gather will support the trial court did. Mr. End.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I would like to start, before I get into my talk, just by answering some of the questions that were asked. Justice Crooks asked, did we get a new trial date after this was taken off the calendar? We had until May 5th to identify our experts with reports, which we did. We had three experts relating to this issue. The defense had until September 5th of 07 for their experts, and the trial was scheduled for June 2nd of 08. There was a question, I think Justice Prosser may have asked it, about where the records come from. The way that we do things in our cases, and we frequently have cases with the same lawyers, and to be green, what we typically do is to have one of the defense lawyers get the records for everybody. And so these records, which are the ones that we're talking about from Frater, we actually got from the hospital's lawyers after they obtain the records with our authorization that we gave to them. There was a comment made about as Tywanda Luckett's death was approaching, there was some urgency for doing things. Nobody knew when her death was approaching. She died of a pulmonary embolism. It was a sudden death. And I think Justice Bradley asked about, well, if you adjourn a trial, isn't that per se prejudice in this setting? And I pulled the brief of Dr. Setti, and at page 17 of Dr. Setti's brief, he says, the rescheduling of trial and the expense involved in doing that and additional discovery are legitimate concerns which can be remedied by adjournment and further proceedings. So my position is, even if there's an adjournment that is not necessarily a prejudicial thing for the defense in this setting, and they say so in their own brief. And there was some discussion made about whether or not at the time that I made the admission on July 22nd, 2005, we have stipulated that Tywanda Luckett was at that point in a persistent vegetative state. The defense has argued throughout, and this is their major argument as I read their briefs, that, gee, if we had only been able to have this out-of-state doctor come in and examine her, and my answer is he would have found a patient in a persistent vegetative state. When the experts who have done reports for us, subject to the order, did their analysis, it was a record review. You look at the records, you talk to the providers who were caring for Tywanda Luckett, and you can make a determination as to whether or not at any particular point in time she was in a persistent vegetative state or whether she was aware of what was going on. And what I found the day before the pretrial, my assistant came in and said, boy, look what I just found in these Frater records, clearly show that Tywanda Luckett had the capacity to be aware of what was going on, because one of the doctors at Frater said, she seems to understand when I'm asking her, she responds yes or no appropriately. That's not a persistent vegetative state. And the first thing I did when I saw that, the very first thing is I went to the computer, I emailed all of the defense lawyers, and I said, back a year and a half ago, I made this admission, I was unaware of this, I just found them, and I quoted what the three records covering a span of a month and a half or 2 months were saying, and clearly she was not in a persistent vegetative state. Now, your job, I think, is to determine whether or not Judge Foley abused his discretion. The appellants here have the obligation of proving that he abused his discretion. And I think an important part of this whole thing for you to consider is the law is that you have to judge Judge Foley's discretion in this case based upon the facts appearing in the record. And that's the case of Hartung versus Hartung. So things that come in now are not things that Judge Foley had available to him when he made his determination. And I've looked at that transcript of the hearing. There are only 31 pages relating to this issue, pages 9 through 33 and 53 through 58. It takes 20 minutes to read. If you read the transcript of that hearing, it's overwhelmingly convincing, in my view, that the basis was there for Judge Foley to decide the case exactly as he did. And Judge Foley said it himself at the very end of the hearing, and it's in the transcript at page 55. He said, I'm not perceiving from the defense's side of this that there is hard opposition to this request. And he was accurately stating, if you read that 31 pages of the hearing, the biggest thing that the defense raised, and all of the defendants raised it, was, Judge, if you allow Mr. N to do this, we've only got a couple weeks to go to trial. We'll have to take depositions. We'll have to get experts. The big thrust of the defense was, we need a postponement of the trial. Judge Foley then went, he gave them every opportunity, I'll reconvene on Monday to go into this further. They said no. He researched the law. In his decision, he cites the law. He cites it exactly as it is, and he told why he decided that they had not fulfilled the second part of the law. They had not shown that they will be prejudiced in prosecuting or defending the case on the merits. I mean, that's the issue. Does this hurt them? Is this prejudicial to them in defending this case on the merits? My contention is absolutely not. And I was thinking about, now, how did this all come about? What was that request for admissions that I received, something that just came out with none of the seven defense law firms realizing that there were these notes in the records? Or did they find them? And did they say, well, let's try this. We'll send a request for admissions to Mr. End.
Also, it doesn't really make any difference, does it? Well, I mean, if they read them and thought there might be a question, or if they never read them, that really doesn't, I don't think, enter into the statutory standard under 804.11.2, does it?
No, you're right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, it was suggested this morning that the defense was sort of tardy in sending in a doctor to examine the deceased. Did you do that?
I did.
Did I
send a doctor?
Did you send a doctor to determine whether she was in a persistent vegetative state?
I sent a doctor right at this point in time.
What point in time?
When the request for admissions came in, I asked a doctor to go see her and determine whether she was in a persistent vegetative state. He called me and said, she's in a persistent vegetative state.
At the time of admissions?
Yes. Is it, and it's not in the record. I'm just telling you that because you asked.
Is it your contention that the defense should have sent a doctor to examine the deceased earlier than you did?
That's their trial strategy. I can't look into the, and I don't want to make judgment calls for a defense lawyer in this case. They had every right to say, we'll sit back and, you know, if we decide to, we'll do it at some other date. Although, as you saw in the Court of Appeals decision, they had numerous opportunities to do that. You know, when we go in for a scheduling conference, the judge usually says, okay, do you defendants want to have an independent medical exam? Yes, we do. Here's your deadline for doing it. That was never done in this case, and I don't know why it wasn't. And perhaps everybody just was under the belief, you know, she's in a persistent vegetative state. So nobody got around to doing it, and then I got the request for admissions.
Well, assuming if you prevail here, what are you going to say was the period of time that the defendant was not in a persistent vegetative state?
That will be the expert's call based upon the records. And there are records that allow doctors to review them and to determine that at this point in time, Tywanda Luckett was aware of things. There are records. And at some point, she isn't. I mean, at some point, it's clear that she no longer is aware. And you know, this is one of the things that was actually discussed at that hearing. Mr. Grimstad, I think, first said, you know, Judge, even though we have these records, who knows how long it is that she was in a state where she presumably could understand things. And Judge Foley himself said, you have all sorts of options here. It may be that this was a very short time period. It may be that she was on a downhill track, and eventually she got to the point where she couldn't understand. But that's something that expert witnesses will have to determine by looking at all of the records, interviewing the providers, and finding out what their recollections are.
Mr. Ann, do you believe that the approach that a circuit judge should take faced with an issue like this is to attempt to balance the factors that are set forth in 804.112?
I think the judge has two distinct criteria to consider. And I think, you know, first of all, does this request comport with the record? Is this something that justice will be served by? And Judge Foley said, yes, it is. The other issue has the defense proven that it is prejudiced in the defense on the merits? And I think Judge Foley, you know, he in retrospect, he probably should have said more about it, but what he said is there are concerns about the prejudice here, but, you know, I think that when I'm looking at everything, it's not enough to cause me to disallow this motion filed by Mr. End. But I think the judge has an obligation of looking at both of those things. Now, the federal cases I cited in my brief are very, in my view, are very persuasive in a case like this where there's an inadvertent error made. And the party, me in this case, who discovers the error, asks the court to get around the allowance, you know, the admission that I made. And the federal cases, in my reading of them, say, in this situation, we have to look at what is just. Our ultimate goal is to see that justice is done. And there are a couple of cases where there were grievous errors. One case where somebody admitted the statute had run, and then went back and looked, and oh, and it hadn't run. You know, I had filed this in time. And the federal court said, well, for Pete's sake, you know, to uphold this, to say you can't now pursue the case isn't just. That's not right. And you know, we all went to law school, and if we had litigation in the mind, we were thinking, you know, I want to be part of this system that accomplishes justice for people. That's the ultimate goal, I think, of all of us. And when we look in the facts of this case, here, clearly in the records, she was conscious of what was going on. She could respond to the doctors and to say, well, because you missed it, Mr. End, your client is not going to be able to pursue this claim, isn't right. And I don't think that the defense at that hearing raised anything at all in support of the prejudice claim. They didn't make the arguments there that they're making here. And I quoted something in my brief. Let's see if I can find it.
Well, Mr. End, while you're looking for that, you know, a request for admission is a particular character in civil law, and it has teeth to it. It's an important rule, and if you do request for admission and they aren't answered, they're deemed to be admitted, and there are consequences for answering them incorrectly, and they're, it's a pretty strong tool to be used in discovery. Both ways, both sides like to use requests to admit. So it isn't like filing a brief a couple days late, or you know, being short on naming your witnesses maybe by a day or two or something like that. It is different. I almost heard you say that, you know, fairness really should dictate. Yes, in part, but this is a different creature under civil law. It's different than just, boy, what's fair. It is. No? You disagree?
My only ground for disagreement is the federal cases. I mean, there are so many of them that say, in this setting, we look at the two criteria, and if the fact is, and I guess it makes a big difference on whether horrible prejudice is being shown by the party that got the admission, But if there isn't that horrible prejudice being shown, the federal courts, in my view, clearly say, you know, let's do what's right here. You know, should we punish this worthy plaintiff or worthy defendant, whatever side it happens to be on, based upon a mistake that was made? And again, I recognize that if there's horrible prejudice on the part of the other party, the court is justified in saying, we find that they convinced us that there was prejudice to them in defending the case on the merits, then you're right.
What about counsel's argument that his expert cannot perform the same kind of examination that he would have had he had the live body there, even in this persistent state?
That's counsel's argument. And if there's a doctor in America who can say that that has any, if that's correct, I'm happy to hear it. But the only thing that Dr. Cranford would have found, if he had gone within a reasonable period of time when he got my denial, he would have found Tywanda Luckett in a persistent vegetative state. And there is no way in the world that you can hook something up to Tywanda Luckett and say, oh, this persistent vegetative state has been going on for 5 months, 13 days.
Did the trial judge have anything like that before him when he made his finding of prejudice?
Of no prejudice. The hearing, as I say, is only 31 pages, and the bulk of the argument made by the defense was, Judge, we need time to get everything organized. We need an adjournment of the trial if you're going to grant this. So that was not mentioned in any way.
Thank you.
I thought Mr. Sager said that the trial court found prejudice.
I just looked again at that decision. In fact, I have.
Speak in front of the microphone, please.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
What Judge Foley said is, while significant prejudice concerns exist, and then he went on from there. He, when I read this, that doesn't say he found prejudice. He said there are concerns relating it, but it's not enough to convince me to deny this motion. And what I was going to say before,
then what do you think we should do in light of the fact you don't think that the record is good enough?
I think that the record is the record.
Right.
If the record is not good enough because the defense, and again, they've made these arguments before you, they've added these arguments, which in my view, and I tried to answer in my brief, don't make it. I don't think that they have proven prejudice in any event.
So you think, therefore, the trial court should be affirmed even though it didn't make any decision on prejudice?
He implicitly...
They're shot and they didn't do it. That's your position?
My position is that Judge Foley implicitly did decide that issue because he set forth the two issues that needed to be decided. And he said, there are concerns with prejudice, but I'm going to grant the motion. So that, in my view, what he decided was they have not convinced me that there is prejudice here that would warrant me denying Mr. M's motion.
Okay. Also, when I read his decision, I thought that he identified things that he thought were prejudice. And then he balanced the severity of what he found as prejudice with what he thought would be a more complete exposition of the case if the withdrawal were permitted. So I thought he did a balancing rather than using the statute as a two-part test and having to satisfy both parts. What do you have to say to that? You just don't agree that he found it at all?
Yeah, we have what we have as far as the decision goes.
If he didn't find prejudice, what's he balancing? I don't, what's he balancing against the more complete exposition if he didn't find prejudice?
Well, and I, you know, I'm not sure about this, but my reading of the law seems to say that if it's unclear what Judge Foley meant, then the Supreme Court can look for reasons in the record to support Judge Foley's decision, or if you think, oh, this doesn't make sense, you have the right to overrule him. But I think the law, as I read it, is that it's a discretionary decision on the part of the trial court that you uphold unless you come to the conclusion that the trial court was wrong or failed to exercise his discretion, and then you can do something in response to that. But the quote I was looking for before.
So if you were to define prejudice for me as that term is used in the statute, how would you define it?
I don't have it at my fingertips. It's in my brief. And the federal courts very clearly say prejudice is if you lose your ability to present your case or your defense. If there's some sudden thing that comes up that now you are unable to handle, that's prejudice.
So it's a foregone opportunity, an opportunity that you can't get back? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And in fact, as I said in my brief, if in fact Judge Foley had listened to all of this and had said, I'm going to grant Mr. Wren's motion and we're going to trial in 2 weeks, they win. You know, that would not have been right. But they asked Judge Foley, let's adjourn the trial if you're going to do this so that we can get back to where we need to be. And that's what he did. He allowed them their request. So that I don't think in this case they have shown any prejudice. And I've answered the arguments that they've raised in this court in my brief, even though they didn't raise them before Judge Foley.
Counsel, I think that there was prejudice in the court's order that was delineated. And I think it is in the second page when he says, the second prong is more difficult to assess. That's the prejudice prong. We are on the verge of trial. All parties have expended considerable time, effort, and resources in preparation for trial. We, and he means him, have dedicated, he means everyone, we have dedicated a significant block of our calendar, as have the lawyers, and to a lesser extent, some of the witnesses to this trial. Allowing the withdrawal, necessitating additional expert evaluations, testimony, and related discovery requires adjournment. Now we go to he's giving adjournment. Okay. Allowing the withdrawal, necessitating additional expert evaluation, testimony, related discovery requires adjournment of the impending trial. So I understand him to say this. Look, the second prong is prejudice, and people, we're going to adjourn this trial now, and people have expended a lot of time, and as you read the transcript, and as most of us when we were circuit court judges were very concerned about our calendar, and he was very concerned about his calendar, he wasn't going to change the date, told a few jokes, and he wasn't going to change the date. And then he had, so that's the prejudice. But I think of myself sitting as a circuit court judge. Anytime there's a request for adjournment on a case that had been scheduled for trial, that I thought was scheduled for trial and in the near future, that just as a given means like, oh, that's going to be inconvenient for me because now I have to reschedule my calendar. And it's going to mean it's going to be inconvenient for others because they have to reschedule their calendar. And it may even mean more than that. It may mean, if it's real close to trial, that they've put in hours of preparation, that now they're going to actually have to repeat 6 months later or 2 months later or a year later. And so I know as a circuit court judge, that's a hassle. And you can use the term prejudice. That's an inconvenience, and that's prejudicial to them. But on the other hand, if there's an important issue in the case that I think that requires the adjournment to really develop, I don't know if I balance them, but I say, okay, I give a little sermon, I harumph a bit, and then I do it. You know, I adjourn it. And that's what he did here. The only thing that he did differently, though, is he used the words, in his opinion, the proper answer to this dilemma lies in the balancing of the two prongs. So what do you do with that? I mean, I think in reality, that kind of balancing goes on in most judges' minds. If you consider this stuff prejudice, is this stuff that I've set out here prejudice under the law? We've expended considerable time, effort, and resources in preparation for the trial. We're going to have to change our calendars now. Is that considered prejudice under the law?
Well, as I just read from Dr. Sethi's brief, he doesn't think it is. I mean, he's not even making that claim.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think you said this morning, you know, isn't there a degree here that we have to look at? I mean, every time a trial gets postponed, is that necessarily prejudice per se? I don't know that it is. I mean, it happens all the time. It happened a year earlier in this case when one of the defense lawyers had a scheduling problem. So I don't know that that raises itself to the level that in this particular type of case says, Judge Foley, you can't allow this. I still think, in my view, and I think the law supports this, is that it's a discretionary decision with Judge Foley, and he carefully set forth, here is the law. And he even cited in his decision, here's a case that says delay in the trial, rescheduling the trial, can be prejudice. I mean, he knew that.
I think he says it's sufficient to establish, he's citing,
yes.
It's sufficient to establish, which doesn't mean that it is prejudicial,
right.
But it's sufficient to establish it if you want to withhold it.
Mr. End, I wonder what your comment is upon the defendant's argument that we've heard today that in reliance upon the admission, that they forewent the opportunity during the time period after obtaining the admission up until the time of trial, while Ms. Luckett was still alive, to have the independent medical examination done. You have commented, geez, there's no device that can be, to use your phrase, hooked up to Ms. Luckett. They have commented that there are such experts out there who can perform such tests to a sufficient degree of scientific certainty. What is your comment? I'd like to give you the opportunity maybe to flesh that out just a little bit more.
Well, all that I can reply, I mean, I'm just telling you my understanding of the medicine involved here, but my reply, I think, would be, there here is the appellant. They have to convince this court that they were prejudiced and that Judge Foley was in error in implicitly deciding that they were not. I don't think that this court can have a lawyer stand and say, gee whiz, it's a significant thing. I mean,
is the crux of it that because that was information that wasn't brought to the attention of the trial court or wasn't argued or considered at that time, that should be outside of our purview of the review of Judge Foley's decision?
In my view, it's outside of your purview.
For that reason,
and the quote that I was looking for a long time ago is from State versus Rogers. We will not blindside trial courts with reversals based on theories which did not originate in their forum. And that's the Wisconsin
law. Can you say that over, please?
Sure. We will not blindside trial courts with reversals based on theories which did not originate in their forum. And my position is that this side, the defense, had the burden in that hearing to prove that they were prejudiced. That was their obligation, to show Judge Foley that they were. They did not. And therefore, I think that this court
in your role, supervising role, says, I agree, there was not enough there. Judge Foley exercised his discretion rationally in the way that a trial court, a reasonable trial court could do. Therefore, we're going to uphold his decision.
The reason I asked you those questions, besides to serve as a springboard for you reciting it, was to make sure, because you had commented earlier, you said that you had responded to each and every one of the arguments that they had made. And I heard that as being a primary one. And it really does come down to, in your estimation, that because that wasn't argued at the time of what had been, I think, the pretrial conference, or scheduled as the pretrial, but then turned into a motion for continuance or a motion for redaction of the admission, withdrawal of the admission, that precludes that issue being raised successfully in this forum.
I do.
Okay.
I have the red light on.
Thank you, Mr. End.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Howie, before you proceed, I do want to introduce a group that came in and may have to leave before you even finish, and that is Leadership Wapaka County. If the group would please stand so we can recognize them. Good seeing you all. Thank you for coming. If you would like a summary of the case that we're still listening to, Deputy Marshal will be able to give that to you. This is Leadership Wapaka County, sir. Okay. Mr. Howie, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court. Mr. Renn spoke of something we all think of when we go to law school and hopefully retain the thought in our minds for a while afterwards, the accomplishment of justice. And we're all interested in the accomplishment of justice. Accomplishing that goal requires a two-way street, and it requires not just that the plaintiffs be allowed to present the merits of their case, but the defendants be allowed to present the merits of their defense.
And that's a good launching point, counsel, for me to ask the corollary question of you, which I just completed asking Mr. Ann, which isn't it correct for us to review Judge Foley's decision in this matter within the context of the information that was available to him at the time he made it? And I guess I'm going to give you the same opportunity, that, because it seems to be a material part of the argument that I've heard advanced on behalf of the defense at this hearing, which is the foregoing of the opportunity to do the IME. What is your response to Mr. N's argument that since that wasn't brought up at the time of the motion, that is outside of our purview, or should be?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the trial judge was aware of the fact that Ms. Luckett had died. So that was even if not stated in that transcript, it's certainly something everyone, including the judge, was aware of. It's also important to recognize the very tightly constrained time frame under which this entire issue came up. In fact, the defendants had not even the slightest idea that the admissions might be withdrawn until less than 24 hours before the hearing in which this came up.
But if it had been such a material part of the defense's reliance on the admission, okay, we don't have to hire the expert to go find this device, which Mr. N says doesn't exist, but which we've heard from other counsel, is someone's expertise is considerable enough to allow that to be done. If that was such a material part of the reliance, I guess I'm curious to know why that wasn't brought to Judge Foley's attention.
I think, in fairness to trial counsel, it did come up fairly quickly in a short period of time. We would always, as appellate lawyers, and I'm certain as a reviewing court, would always like the record to be somewhat more comprehensive.
Well, I understand de minimis absences, but I guess I'm hearing this is the main focal point of your argument, unless there's something greater that you rely or that you're arguing your clients relied on. This seems to me, I don't know of any greater detriment that you now advance on behalf of your clients that they suffered outside of the IME. Because if you take that out of the equation, I'm not asking to make a point, I'm asking to give you the opportunity. If you take that out of the equation, he's got the notes, you have the notes, he's got experts, as other counsel argued, you're going to find experts to argue on the notes what they mean or don't mean. What greater prejudice was there besides the absence of the IME performed on behalf of the defendants?
Well, the absence of the IME is exacerbated by the loss of the death of principal expert on this subject, one of the brightest stars in his field. And that fact directly does...
That was the individual that performed, was involved with the Terry Schiavo matter?
That's correct, Dr. Cranford, who died during the period of time that the admission was operative. So losing that doctor during that period...
But didn't he die after she died?
And certainly could have done some work during the time that she was alive, may even have been able to weigh in on what remained. Without any... without the ability to consult that expert, that directly affects the prejudice and exacerbates it for the defense. And is one reason why we're not able at that hearing to present the sort of evidence this court has talked about this afternoon concerning what that expert might have been able to do. But the record is clear that the parties discussed the notion of prejudice, the fact that they would have to be, would be affected detrimentally by the absence of the ability to examine the plaintiff, or Ms. Luckett in this case. With respect to that fact, however, that is not just a question that impacts the issue of prejudice. It's also directly relevant to the presentation of the merits. And it's important to recognize as well that Mr. M's suggestion that the records he discovered on the eve of trial made it, as he put it, he said that they clearly showed that that Ms. Luckett knew what was going on and was able to consciously experience pain and suffering. In fact, the records say nothing of the sort. And what they do, the effect that they do have, is not to conclusively resolve a question of fact, as was the case in some of the federal cases that have been cited concerning requests to admit under the federal rule.
And I think you have highlighted the contingent nature of some of those, or contingent isn't the right word, it seems like she can track. But I do want to call you back to material prejudice. We've heard you did an excellent job of making your point in that regard at your original presentation. What other material prejudice, really in a nutshell, in a few sentences or less, we're all aware the red light's on, but in a few sentences or less, what is the other material prejudice suffered besides the absence of the IME?
The death of the expert and the anticipated fading of memories and deterioration of other evidence over the period of time that was at issue. All of those act not just individually but in concert to deprive the defense of a crucial element of its defense and directly prejudice it in a manner that ought to have been considered more seriously and should have prevented the withdrawal of the admissions in this case.
Is the test material prejudice? Where does the material come from?
I don't believe that material is a word that I've used, but I think it's a fair test to say that it does need to be...
Material to what?
You're not going to stand here and argue that de minimis prejudice ought to hinder.
Certainly not. But material prejudice, something that does affect the defendants in their ability.
Prejudicial prejudice.
or to use the definition that the federal cases have used, and I believe this
Let's
is...
Let's use that definition.
The definition that that Mr. N was referring to, and I had him at a disadvantage because I was able to look it up, the difficulty a party may face in proving its case because of the sudden need to obtain evidence. And that's something that the defense faced here. The need to obtain evidence no longer available in certain respects because of the passage of time and, more importantly, the death of the most important person to the case, and another person very important to the defense.
So that's the definition of prejudice.
That's the definition that the Eighth Circuit has given in the Manat case, which is cited in a number of places and appears in a number of other cases as well.
Affects the trial. Affects your ability to try the case.
To present, present your defense. And that directly impacts upon the question of the presentation of the merits. My time is expired. I would hope to address that.
We're almost expired, too. It's been a long hearing. Do you want to sum up in a couple of sentences?
Certainly, Your Honor. This that the defense has suffered in this case, withdrawal of the admission dovetails with the presentation of the merits. It affects the ability not only of the defense to present its case, but of the fact finder at trial to resolve the case. It does not subserve the presentation of the merits to allow one party's apparently careless admission to stall discovery on a perishable issue, only to revive that issue later in a vastly different evidentiary landscape. By allowing withdrawal on these facts, the Court of Appeals decision makes admissions inherently unreliable and diminishes the trust that they are meant to promote. Restoring that trust means reversing the lower courts, and we respectfully request that this court do just that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Howey. We appreciate your coming into the state to argue this case in Wisconsin, and your admission has ceased as of the end of this argument. We want to thank Mr. End and Mr. Sager also for their arguments on this procedural issue relating to admissions, which does not come up very frequently in our court. And that ends our hearing in 07AP308, Tewanda Luckett versus Aaron Bodner. That ends our proceeding. Are the students leaving? Yes? Okay. Let me call our next case then, and